This week on Family Anatomy, Anatomy of Compassion.
The hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologists. So if you want to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you can get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information, with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spazzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. We're talking about compassion today.
Anatomy of Compassion.
Anatomy of Compassion. And it's, you know, you suggested this topic, Giuseppe, and I thought, didn't we talk about compassion already? I went back to the web, I searched my own website to see what what have we talked about?
Well, we've done 90-some shows now.
Yeah, this is number 92, if I'm not mistaken. I know we've gotten the count wrong in the past.
And your memory's failing, so.
And it is.
It makes sense.
They say it's the first thing to go.
Back.
I'm approaching middle age now.
Now, from what I recall, we have not done this before. Did you find something that makes my memory look even worse than yours?
Here's what happened. You wrote an article about empathy and morality being hardwired, and we can talk about that a little bit if you want to. And we did emotional intelligence, and that's sort of what I was thinking, okay, right, that must have been what jogged my memory.
Right, and I think these things are related, so compassion, you could kind of interchange that a little bit with the word empathy, let's say, and empathy would be one of the emotional intelligences, not all of them, but one aspect, let's say.
Yeah, sure. In fact, if you go on your computer and type compassion and do a thesaurus search, guess what you find? Empathy.
You do.
That's there.
Now, the thing about compassion, though, there's something about compassion that's a little broader. It has this sort of spiritual aspect to it, I guess, you know, that tends to come out of a lot of different religious traditions. They talk about compassion. They don't talk about empathy so much.
When I think of compassion, part of it is you're feeling something for another person who's having a hard time. It's different from empathy in that way. I guess empathy is a broader term, whereas compassion is sharing a feeling of sorrow maybe for someone.
Yeah, it's more specifically related to that. But it can also be just reaching out to someone generally. So on your side of it, there's a sense of love that's coming out in response to that sorrow.
This is true. You know, and the other thing that we did talk about before was we did a show where we talked about values and the things we hope to pass on to our kids. And I think I didn't go back and now this would be pretty bad if I have to search the website to find out what we've talked about before. And then I have to listen to the episode to see if I remember it right.
All 92.
Yep. 90, it's only 46 hours or so.
Now what were you going to say? Because I'm pretty sure I remember.
When we did that episode, I think we called it Anatomy of Dad's Wisdom or something like that.
Right.
I think compassion and empathy were things that we talked about in terms of. And I think many parents would say the same thing. We want our kids to grow up and be able to have that feeling for another person.
Yeah, totally makes sense. Now, would you describe yourself as a compassionate person?
Absolutely not.
No.
In no way, shape, or form.
Perfect.
Completely.
So, we should have just said, forget about the podcast, and I could have given you some of my abundant compassion.
This is true.
And that could have been, you know, a better use of our time.
Well, this is a problem. When you sit down in a room with PhDs and you start asking questions like that, the problem with going to school for a long time and achieving your PhD, narcissists are overrepresented in that group.
There you go.
So we tend to look out for number one. So what am I going to tell you?
Now,
Well, we picked a job where you have to feel compassion for other people. I mean, that's what we chose as our profession.
That's right. That's right. And it's a very basic thing, in particular for therapy, to have that sort of grounding, and that you can have a lot of different techniques that you're using in your therapy with people. If it's not sort of embedded and based in a sense of empathy and compassion that the client or the patient feels, a lot of these techniques don't work.
It's not genuine. If you don't feel any empathy for the other person that you're working with, it can come off as disingenuous for sure. And I think find it difficult to work with someone if I didn't have some kind of a connection with them in that way. And that's where the empathy, I think, comes in. There's a connection that you have with the other person in order to be able to have some understanding of how they're feeling. That's the foundation. You can't have compassion for someone else unless you can understand there's a perspective-taking piece to it, and there's a cognitive part where you need to understand where the other person's coming from.
Yeah, there's both pieces. It's necessary but insufficient, let's say. Right? Remember that old phrase?
Oh, my goodness.
Remember that old phrase, right?
Now, we had so many of those in school, right?
We did.
Correlation does not imply causation. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
It develops over time, though. Empathy or compassion develops over time, so that, you know, that partly, let's say you take a 1.5-year-old, right?
Yep.
1.5-year-old's got that, just developing that ability to sort of look over if someone's crying and maybe sort of be like, maybe walk closely over to the person or even stand in there that one spot and sort of be curious about the emotion that they're seeing. It's not a well-developed, mature compassion or empathy that they're able to have at that point.
Well, there's prerequisites that they need to develop, right? You need to be able to see yourself as distinct from someone else, and you need to start to develop that theory of mind before you can put yourself in the other person's shoes and realize, wow, that's a person who's feeling really sad and I feel for them. I want to help them.
And so that's it. There's this cognitive development that happens over time. And, you know, you might get to the point where you see a 4-year-old and they might be able to, they're going to respond better, obviously, than a 1.5-year-old. But at the same time, it might confuse them to see a lot of intense emotions in another person, and because they recognize it, but they won't know what to do about it. And that's where that confusion comes in, so that you might get them being nice to the person, or you might even see a four-year-old being upset with that person because stirring up feelings in themselves that they don't know how to handle. And
yeah. You might see that nervous laughter or something like that. You know, I read a review of some of the literature about the development of these kinds of skills. And when it comes to being able to identify emotions in others, the review that I read showed basically that some of the research is mixed, but their thinking was between the ages of about 3 and about 5, kids' skills in terms of identifying others' emotions, not knowing what to do about it, but identifying the emotions of other people, that's where it starts to develop. It sort of plateaus around early adolescence somewhere in terms of changes over the age span.
Right, because even though, say, at say 5, 6 years old, you can recognize your feelings, you can recognize the feelings of another person, you still might not know what to do about it. And really, if you think about it, yes, it develops even further into your teen years, but even after that, it can become very complex.
You know, and psychologists who study child development, you may know this, but you may not.
Yes.
See empathy or compassion as being a cornerstone skill in terms of being able to control aggression, being able to engage in altruistic kinds of behaviors, you know, doing something for someone else, again, pro-social reasoning, being able to think through and problem solve in a way that's not, I mean, what's the opposite, right? It's antisocial behavior. And so if you don't have some kind of an I mean, a lack of empathy is what you see in someone with an antisocial personality.
That's right. That's right. And which is, you know, can make your life as the person who's lacking that compassion very, very difficult, as well as the people around you.
Yeah, I mean, you may not realize how difficult you're making your life if that's the case, but certainly you can make things difficult for other people.
Yeah. Now, here's just a taste of how complex, because I've used that word a couple of times now. How is it complex? Do you feel compassion for someone that you think is responsible for their ills? Do you know what I mean? That this is how, even as an adult, it gets really complicated. If you think they're responsible, you're less likely to be compassionate.
And
if you can see that there's something else that's responsible and they're just suffering, then you're more likely to be compassionate.
And that's a problem, because we're biased towards seeing other people as, you know, other people's behavior as being generated by them because of their personality, whereas for ourselves, it's more dictated by circumstance.
That's right, and we've done posts about that.
We certainly have. Yeah. You could search on familyanatomy.com right now. We could just read to you from our website.
So what about, do you feel compassion for someone when you're the victim of their hurtful behavior and that now they're feeling guilty? Do you feel compassion for them feeling guilty? You see, it gets really convoluted. I mean, especially, like I say, as you get older, there's still a lot of different, here's another one. Do you feel compassion? Well, if someone's on the street, they're homeless, right? Do you feel compassion for that person every time and so give money every time?
Or do you eventually get used to it until you don't even notice anymore?
And then here's another.
This is like philosophy 101 that you're doing.
Well, no, wait
here.
A minute. This is real life.
Yeah,
I know you
true.
Live in the country. There's no homeless people there. This
no,
is not philosophy.
Has,
this is just walk up the street.
Everybody has a roof over their head where I live. Yeah,
yeah.
That's true.
Here's another thing. Your ability to be compassionate is also dependent on how much pain you can absorb from the person that you're talking to. Someone's in front of you and they're really upset. You might be in a period of your life where you're very upset and you can't hear what they're saying. It overwhelms you. So now you can't be compassionate.
Okay.
No, you understand that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's,
sure.
You know, you have different capabilities
well,
depending on that time in your life. If you're suffering because, let's say you're, you know, someone died in your family recently and someone is hurt and you see them, maybe you can't absorb any more hurt. You know, that's possible.
Well, we always say that as a psychologist who works with families, one of the things that we talk to people and families about is that you need to look after yourself in order to be able to look after the other person. And that's part of just what you're saying, right? You can't take on the role as the caretaker if you're not taking care of yourself at all.
And that brings us to something that I've been reading in the literature called self-compassion.
Self-compassion.
Have you heard this? This is a new kind of area of research that's getting a lot of momentum lately.
Mm-hmm.
Different from self-esteem.
Is this part of the positive psychology movement, would you say?
It could very well be.
It sounds a little bit like a positive psychology idea.
Different from self-esteem because it's not... You're not talking about sort of self-congratulatory stuff like, I'm great, I'm this, I'm that.
No, it sounds more like self-care.
It's more like self-care. It's more like treating yourself as a friend would treat you, a good friend. And they found people with high levels of self-compassion are better able to deal with stress. It's like a protective factor.
Mm-hmm.
So that you have a lot of stress in your life, if you're treating yourself well and taking care of yourself and saying the right things to yourself, right?
Right.
You're better able to handle stress. You're also, according to the research, you're better able to take responsibility for the things that you might have done to create stress in your life.
Hmm.
So in other words, when you're taking responsibility, it's, you know, usually it's something that's difficult to do. Well, that means part of it was my doing. And usually if you say that, then it's it's hard on you.
So how do they know? How do they demonstrate who has self-compassion in a study like that?
They have questionnaires so that they do the questionnaires and they split them and they do correlations after with another set of questionnaires that says these kinds of events have happened.
It seems like that would be something that would be hard to tease out because we've also seen lots of studies and written about them on our website about the benefits of regular exercise in terms of dealing with stress, the benefits of relaxation and meditation. Both are things that someone who has self-compassion, I mean, likely that's how it's operationalized. That's how they do it. Somebody who is going to the gym on a regular basis and looking after themselves is likely to be someone who would be high on that questionnaire, right?
Yes, but I think it's more than just taking care of yourself physically or taking care of yourself in terms of the food you eat. It's more has to do with treating yourself well, and this is an interesting thing too. Role play. You're in therapy with someone, right? And they talk to themselves in very negative ways.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good. I'm not a good person. I'm not very smart. I'm not, I don't do well at my job. I don't, I'm not a very good father or I'm not a very good mother. And you have these negative things you're saying to yourself. You can turn that around with role play and have you be the client or the patient and tell the patient that they're going to be your best friend and try and talk to you as the therapist and be, a good friend to them, right? What would a good friend say to you? So you talk to yourself as if you were a good friend to yourself.
And that's something that often the people who you see in your office, often it's hard for them to answer the question because a question I put to lots of people who come to see me, usually if I'm meeting with someone individually, they're not 6 or 7 or 8, but it might be a young adolescent or a teenager. A question I sometimes like to ask is, okay, how would your best friend describe you? And so it's not them telling you about them. It's them trying to figure out what their friends would say. And sometimes that's hard for people to answer.
It's hard because
they don't think of themselves in that way.
Because the role play is a good way to get that out there. Mm-hmm. So that they're forced to think of, how would a really good friend treat me? Generally, you're going to have at least one person that you can think of that's treated you decently in your life.
Mm-hmm. The whole idea of that exercise is that the people who are coming into your office or are feeling very anxious or are feeling very low might have an unrealistic view of themselves and may even wonder, well, why do I even have friends? Why does anyone care about me? Because this is how I see myself. So to ask them, well, what would your friend say? What would the person that you've been going to school with for the last 6 years, how would they describe you? What are the things about you that they like? Why do they hang around? That's why they're in therapy sometimes, is that they can't answer those questions.
That's right. That's right. And they could be depressed as well.
Yeah.
Now, is there such a thing as too much compassion?
Well, is that where you get secondary traumatization and things like that?
And you get a lot of resentment. Right, you could get a lot of it's part of it is you're giving of yourself when you're compassionate towards someone else, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're giving too much of yourself, there's a chance that you might end up being resentful because the other person can't keep up with all the giving that you're doing.
Sure, because a relationship needs to be reciprocal, right? You can't just be taking, or just giving.
That's right, and. If you're giving so much that the other person, I know cases where a person was giving so much that the person who's receiving all of that compassion felt odd.
Yeah.
Felt
a little
really odd.
Yeah.
Like, why? Where's this coming from? Why am I such an incredible beneficiary here of this good feeling towards me and this care for me, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where's this coming from?
But
I'm not that nice.
At the same time, the fact is that we want our kids to have some compassion for other people. not to the point where they're sacrificing themselves at every turn, but we want them to be at least somewhat compassionate. When you think about aggression and things like that, that's the opposite. If you feel compassion and you feel empathy for other people, you're less likely to be the bully because you can sit in the other person's shoes. We talked before about programs and some studies that have been done that looked at emotional intelligence and how do you increase that. But there is a program in Canada, at least, that operates in schools that is really working hard and it's aimed at increasing empathy in young kids called Roots of Empathy. Right? And you've looked into this program a little bit.
I looked into this because when we had our second child, I took a 6 months leave from my job to be with my wife and my child. And during the course of that, it was a great thing to do, and I was immersed in that kind of experience, and I happened upon this program, and it just seemed to fit with me so well, the idea that you would take, correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a while since I've looked into it, mm-hmm. but you would take, or a parent takes a newborn into a classroom, and there's a guided discussion around the newborn and what the newborn might be feeling, what the newborn is, how they're developing. And there's a kind of a guided discussion around that helps bring a sense of compassion or empathy forward for the kids that are having that discussion towards this little infant.
Right. I mean, what the program is meant to do is to improve things like perspective taking. And they call it emotional literacy, even, to be able to recognize others' emotions, and to do that by using an infant as the teacher is the way they have.
Now, it doesn't happen just the one time. It's something that happens over time.
Yeah, there's a couple of dozen meetings, and usually the babies are, at the beginning, the babies are between 2 and 4 months. And they try to have a variety of parents and different kinds of families in the program, so it's okay for a single mom to be the person who brings their baby. It's okay for a two-parent family to be the right? And so they bring this little baby in. There's a facilitator who's like the group leader who begins the discussion with the kids before the parent comes in.
Who's trained by the Roots of Empathy people.
Exactly. So they're trained in this program. And I think over the course of 27 meetings, the kids learn to recognize emotion. They learn about all of the dangerous things that are dangerous in the world for infants.
They're putting themselves in the shoes of the infant.
Right. And what you hope is going to develop over those 27 weeks is an ability to put yourself in the other person's shoes and to be compassionate, to be more empathic.
It sounds like a great program.
Well, and there's some research to back it up. I mean, they've done some studies that looked at a number of different things. I mean, the program starts, I think the earliest ones for Roots of Empathy, they start in kindergarten and they go up to grade 8. And then there's another program called Seeds of Empathy for younger kids. Okay. But for the older adolescents, they're even talking about prevention of teen pregnancy and things like that.
And definitely lower levels of aggressive behavior.
Yeah, lower levels of aggressive behavior. The kids who've been through the program are much better at explaining the reasons why someone might feel a certain way in a given situation. So they have better explanations for those kinds of things. There's a reduction in aggression. But there's also not just a reduction in aggression, but an increase in positive social behaviors too.
You know, it sounds like a very brilliant program. If you think about the difference between just reading about empathy and this experiential kind of learning, it's like having you wanted to have a bunch of kids learn about space, let's say, mm-hmm. and there was an astronaut that came in every week, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
You had that experiential learning, but that's a typical kind of thing that you were, you could understand a little bit more as part of a curriculum that someone who's in that position themselves, a physician, an astronaut, whoever the person would be, would come in and through experience, you learn about that particular profession. This is learning how to be a compassionate person, a person who understands feelings, who can put themselves in someone else's shoes, have that perspective taking. It's not generally part of the curriculum ever, but what an important personal life skill that is.
It's learning about caring for, the whole thing, it's learning about caring for another person. Part of it is modeling that positive parent-child relationship. Part of it is learning about the fact that an infant is totally dependent on the people who are around him or her and constantly needs help. That's the ultimate altruism, right? It's different for these kids who might have a younger brother or sister because, when you have a younger brother or sister, there's a competition for attention and things like that. But in the Roots of Empathy program, there's none of that. And they do really, the facilitators really work hard to encourage everyone to participate and ask questions and be involved. And they're finding that there's a positive impact to that.
It makes sense.
So that's one program that looks at increasing empathy or developing compassion in kids. Are there any other things, maybe practical things, do you think, for parents in terms of helping their kids to develop these skills? One of the things I thought of was modeling, right? If you want your kids to be compassionate, you need to behave in a compassionate way, right? Things like volunteering and stuff like that is one way to demonstrate your compassion sort of outwardly, right?
That's right. Modeling is always an important thing. I think that kids learn from seeing, especially people they look up to, parents.
Yeah. And we talked about how compassion is dependent on being able to recognize another person's emotions. And so I think it's important to talk about those at home, to label your feelings, to give the kids words to talk about feelings, because they don't have those when they're very young, right? There's a very black and white. I'm either really mad or everything's great. But there's so many areas in between that you can help them learn to recognize and give a voice to in an appropriate way, right? If you just talk about your own feelings.
And it's experiential learning, again, I think, is the important part of it. It's not like you're going to sit there with a chalkboard and start teaching them about their different feelings and what they are.
Right.
Although that's not, it's not that that's bad. It's just that they're going to learn more from actually seeing you behave in such a way that, they're likely to model that themselves later for someone else because they're learning it from you.
Yeah, I know there are different ways to talk about those kinds of things. I remember because I'm interested in, I used to do some drawing and cartooning and things like that when I was in school, and I've always been interested in the artwork and the kids' books and things. So if we're reading a story, we can look, if there's good artwork in a kid's story, we can talk about the emotions of the characters in that book. And some of those can be pretty complicated. There's a book that we read before Christmas about how Santa got his job. In fact, I think that's one that I wrote about on the website, about how Santa Claus got his job. And there's this great picture about Santa working in a zoo. This is how he met his reindeer friends. And he and the reindeer became best buddies, and all the other animals are jealous. And there's just this great picture of Santa feeding the reindeer, and all the other animals are behind his back, sort of glaring at him. And they're kind of jealous. Maybe yep. They're a little mad, and the drawings are so great that the kids recognize that right away, and we could talk about that, and it was a lot of fun.
That's another way. And now, some of the research I was looking at was showing that girls have higher levels of compassion, generally speaking, than boys, but that with teaching, the gap between the two can be closed.
It's funny that the research that I read was a little bit varied. They did talk about that. One of the reasons, some of the researchers believe that happens, mm-hmm. Why are girls more compassionate, is because girls have a higher capacity for guilt. Some of the researchers are saying that if you are more likely to feel guilty about things yourself, it's easier for you to show compassion for someone else who's in a bad situation, which I thought was a little bit...
You feel responsible, so therefore you're going to reach out.
You're more likely to, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of an odd, compassion and guilt going together. Doesn't sound quite like it jives, but I guess
Now, there's another explanation for that, too, that, you know, we empower boys generally more than we empower girls,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's tons of overlap, and we're better at that than we used to be. But the person who's highly empowered has less incentive to be compassionate.
Yep.
And so that's part of the reason there's a gap there. There's this old...
Well, and one of the studies that I read showed that it changes over time, that at the age of 3, that girls are more compassionate than boys, but by the time they're 5 or 6, some studies are showing that it reverses. And they are thinking that maybe that's because of the way the school system is organized to reinforce those pro-social behaviors, that boys really get into the reinforcement part of it. Like you said, they can learn those things, and boys seem to be picking it up, so they're not just catching up to the girls, they're even surpassing them in some ways in terms of their compassion.
Yeah, but there is this relationship between power and compassion, right?
That the more powerful you are,
the less need you have to be compassionate, right? I remember there's this old cartoon that I saw many years back, and there was these 3 fish. There's this one little fish. Let's see if I can remember this now.
You're going to ruin the story. I know it.
There's 3 fish. There's a tiny little fish off to the left, then a medium-sized fish in the middle, and a huge fish over on the right.
Right.
And the little fish is just about to get eaten and says, the world is very, very unfair. Right?
Mm-hmm.
The middle fish is about to eat the little one.
And be eaten by the big one.
And be eaten by the big one. So the middle fish says, the world is sort of fair. And then the huge fish says, the world is unfolding just as it should.
If you're more powerful, you need less compassion in your life, maybe. That's true. But people, I think, need to realize that with great power comes great responsibility.
Yes, sir, Spider-Man.
I always wanted to say that into a microphone. With great power comes great
responsibility. And I set that up for you beautifully.
And
see
you did. Yeah, and then you gabbed on for a little while I was ready to...
You're ready to
knock it
down.
How am I going to get this in there? And I did. Good. But I think that brings us to the top 3 things.
All right. And the number one thing to remember for parents is the cognitive capacity does not develop right away in an infant. It takes time. At about 4 or 5 years of age, you start to see that they're able to recognize emotions in themselves and in others. They still might not know what to do about that, but that's something that with learning develops over time and can, as we said earlier, can get very complex. So it's a lifelong learning, really.
And the number 2 thing is we've talked about how experiential learning can be a real bonus when it comes to figuring out these kinds of things like emotional intelligence or empathy or compassion for that matter. So role playing is one way that kids can start to figure that out, modeling for the kids the compassion that you hope that they'll show. And I think it's good for your kids to at least consider how would their best friend treat them. What would their best friend say about them? That's how you be a friend to yourself.
That's it. And the third thing to remember is that teach your kids about self-compassion. There's new research on this now. It's shown itself to be very important. The way they're treating themselves, not just in terms of eating well and exercising, which we've talked about the importance of that before, but emotionally, how are they treating themselves as well? It's something that if they have a lot of can help them absorb stress better and can help them even take responsibility for the things that happen in their life without falling into a depression and really being able to integrate that in a healthy way.
And that brings us to our website of the week.
And the website of the week this week is charterforcompassion.org. There's a charter that's been developed by, I think she's a writer mm-hmm. in England. Karen Armstrong is her name.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, I think 20, 30 years ago, she was a nun.
Right, so and she left the faith.
She left the faith altogether. Seems like she was an atheist for quite some time.
Yeah.
And then she started studying world religions and started to see that in all the faith traditions, there was a sense of compassion that was at the basis of them, that golden rule that you hear about.
Do unto others.
Right. It was not just in Christianity or just in Judaism, but in Hinduism, in Buddhism, in a lot of different world religions. And so she started to realize that, and we've talked about this during the show a little, that you know, high levels of compassion is sort of incongruous with aggression. And so this was an idea to bring about a peace movement through promoting a charter for compassion.
Right. I mean, we know from working with families and doing therapy that if you want to change behavior, you don't punish the bad behavior, you try and promote the good.
That's right.
And so this is an example of that. So like a charter of rights and freedoms, this is a charter of compassion. And right away, what jumped out at me at the site, and partly because we talked about modeling, is that there's also a place where people can share their own acts of compassion. So you can write a few lines or a few words about something that you've done or witnessed, and that's there to be shared with the rest of the world. So what Karen Armstrong, though, wants to do is take this charter. She wants to have as many signatures as possible. And at the end, well, I guess she would have just sent it away just before our
December
31st, 2009,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
So December 31st, 2009, she's sending all of those signatures to five leaders of countries who are involved in conflict. And so she's hoping that they'll take into account that movement, the Charter for Compassion.
And that's our website of the week for this week.
charterforcompassion.org. You can go there and sign your name.
And that's it for us. You can visit us at familyanatomy.com or email us at info@familyanatomy.com. And as always, Dr. Brian has an announcement.
Well, I guess the announcement this week is that we've been working on the website. We've been trying to change some things around. And I guess what I would say is that anybody who pops by familyanatomy.com, drop us a line. Let us know what you think. If you have any suggestions for changes in how it's organized or for things that you'd like to see on the site, things that you'd like us to write about or talk about on the show, you can email us at familyanatomy.com, info@familyanatomy.com, or you can leave a comment on the website. And like I say, we're sort of in flux right now. We're making some changes and moving some things around. So it's kind of exciting for us, but we'd love to get your input on that.
We would. And we also want to say Happy New Year. It's the first show of the new year.
Happy New Year, everybody.
And we want to thank people for getting the word out about our show and about the website. It's really helping us, and we really appreciate it.
And we'll leave you once more with a bit of a tune by Brother Love, who's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening.
FamilyAnatomy.com